Beautiful place. So, okay, so I'm going to talk about the relationship between quantum mechanics and the arrow of time. And but before starting, I couldn't resist putting up some few statements about what is time. This is not really related to my talk, but it was too nice to pass up. So this is maybe the most used quote, a quotation about time. What is time? If no one asks me, I know what it is. But if I wish to explain it to him who asks, I don't know. This is by St. Augustine. I think it wraps it up very nicely. And then, however, if you go to places where they keep track of this, time is the most commonly used noun in written English. Somehow, we're talking about things we don't know about. And here I put up some quite obvious statements about time, like time flows, it does so at a uniform rate, the present somehow exists, the past existed, and the future does not exist yet. But if you think about it, they're not wrong. They're all wrong, or at least you have to be careful of how you attach meaning to these statements. For example, time flows with respect to what? To time? That doesn't make much sense. And uniform rate with respect to what? I mean,
a second per second? That also doesn't make sense.
They're quite obvious statements. And regarding the last one, most scientists would say that basically time is just a coordinate. It's just like space. There's no particular meaning to the present, to the past, to the future. And this is, for example, the opinion apparently also of Albert Einstein. He was quoting on the death of his collaborator Michele Besso. He said, "For us believing physicists, the distinction between past, present, and future is only an illusion, even though it's a stubborn one." I mean, that for people, as soon as you think about it, you very quickly come to these same conclusions, but they are quite striking at first. Okay, but what, now let's go to my talk. I'm not really interested in the nature, I mean, I'm interested, but I'm not going to talk about the nature of time. I'm going to talk about the arrow of time. So why the slices of fixed time in the block universe are arranged in a well-defined order. So in layman terms, we can say why time appears to flow in a definite direction. Of course, flow is between double quotation marks because it doesn't really make sense. But so if we are shown a movie of a macroscopic phenomenon, in most cases we know whether the movie is being played backwards or not. That is, some phenomena are irreversible. However, and this of course is described by the second law of thermodynamics. However, the microscopic phenomena are always reversible. And this is what I'm going to talk about, how to reconcile the irreversibility of microscopic dynamics with the reversibility of microscopic dynamics. Okay, so this is the outline of my talk. I will start from the Loschmidt paradox. I will relate events and information. And then I will talk about, I will give two thought examples of what I'm talking about, and that maybe will make it clear. And then I will give the general theory and talk about why quantum mechanics is necessary for my theory to work. A few words on quantum cosmology, and then I will conclude with an important objection and a way to overcome it. Okay, so let's start. The Loschmidt paradox is basically, how can we obtain irreversible phenomena from the reversible time symmetric physical laws? So obviously entropy is constant if we have reversible transformation, and the microscopic dynamics, for example, Schrödinger equation, is governed by reversible laws. So how come, how can we say that entropy increases? This is, of course, a problem for the statistical interpretation of the second law of thermodynamics, and it was pointed out very early on when the statistical interpretation was presented. And of course, there have been presented many solutions to this problem, but most people would agree that the matter is not fully settled yet. So what are the hypotheses of the solution I'm going to present? I suppose that quantum mechanics is valid at all scales. And of course, up to now, we have no reason to think that this is not the case, but of course, we have tested quantum mechanics only in a very limited range of physics, so we don't really know if it's the case or not. This is, of course, highly controversial, but at some point it will be settled. In any case, it is certainly a good working hypothesis, and this is the hypothesis I will be working with. Okay, quantum mechanics is valid at all scales, not only for microscopic phenomena, but at all scales. Okay, and now two words about entropy, thermodynamic entropy. There are many ways to introduce it, depending on the different axiomatizations of thermodynamics, but it's basically a quantity that measures how usable energy gets degraded into heat. The von Neumann entropy, on the other hand, of course, you all know what that is. It's just a quantity that measures the amount of information in the system and is defined in this way, where rho is the density matrix of the system. And of course, there are these conceptual constructs, Maxwell demons and Szilard engines, that can convert bits of thermodynamic entropy with bits of information. So in some sense, these two quantities, although they are quite different, can be converted one into the other. And this is what I will need. Just to remind you, the Maxwell demon and the quantum treatment, the Maxwell demon is a hypothetical being that lives in a gas chamber at thermal equilibrium. The gas chamber is divided by a partition in two parts. And basically, the demon will open the trap door every time a fast molecule approaches from one side and every time a slow molecule approaches from the other side. So basically, he starts from a system in which you have thermodynamical equilibrium. The gas molecules have average velocity equal in the two partitions, but he ends up in a state where the entropy has decreased because the slow molecules will be on one side of the partition and the fast molecules will be on the other side. So it seems a second law violation, and this was the spirit in which Maxwell presented the demon. But of course, if you do a quantum treatment of this demon, this was done by Charlie Bennett and Seth Lloyd, you see that this is not the case. In order to sort the molecule, the demon somehow must measure their velocity, or at least must get correlated with their velocities, and this measurement result is stored in his memory. The final state will have lower thermodynamic entropy, but it will have higher von Neumann entropy. And of course, he can erase the memory in order to restore the whole system to the initial state, but this erasure will entail an entropy increase due to the Landauer's principle, which balances out the entropy gain. Okay, so there's no second law violation, of course, by this mechanism. But what is interesting of all this construct is that it gives a way to convert von Neumann and thermodynamic entropy. So there is a one-to-one trade-off between these two quantities. So we can talk about one, and what we say about one can be applied to the other and vice versa. Okay, and now let's go and describe what how we store information about events. By again, I'm citing Landauer. Information is physical, which means that any record of an event can be decorrelated from it by a physical transformation. Any record of an event will be stored onto a physical degree of freedom, and of course, it can be decorrelated by using some physical transformation. And once you see that, you realize that what happens if I erase all the events, all the records of an event? And then, of course, that situation is indistinguishable from the event not having happened at all. OK? Okay, what do I mean by radically erasing the records of an event? Of course, it's clearly not sufficient to erase, like with a rubber eraser or things like that, the description of an event on a piece of paper. We want to ensure that even in principle, it is impossible to recover the information in any way. Okay, so this is what I mean by radically erasing. And of course, this can be done, for example, if we invert the dynamics that correlated the event and the information carrier in the first place. And if we do that for all the information carriers about an event, then the situation is really indistinguishable from the event not having happened. Okay? And of course, now this event could be an event where entropy has increased. And then we have basically erased the event, and this means that we have this decreased entropy. But of course, there will be no second law violation because this is indistinguishable to the event not having happened. Of course, this seems very contrived, and the obvious question is, can this really happen? And under the hypothesis I was using that quantum mechanics is valid, the answer is yes. And I will present a very simple thought experiment in which we see this happening. Sure.
So suppose that something happens.
Right.
And then I very carefully go in and I engineer a Hamiltonian that runs things backward.
Right.
And undoes what happened. Yeah. So then we erase that event.
Yeah.
It never happened.
You have to be careful on how you do that, but that's one way of doing it. Sure.
Right. I certainly remember that I erased the event.
Right.
So perhaps the event never happened,
sure.
But there is a record that the event happened and then erased at sort of second order.
Sure. But the important thing is that when I'm talking about entropy decrease, is that it will be clear maybe after I give this example. When I talk about entropy decrease, I mean that you might remember that the event was undone, but the entropy increase that was caused by that event, you won't be able to remember. It will be clear in a moment. If not, please ask again, okay? So this is a very simple example, and we have Alice in her isolated lab, and she has a spin 1/2 state, which is initially is in a pure state pointing to the right. And of course, we can write that as a superposition of up and down. And it's a pure state, so it has entropy zero. And now she measures it with a Stern-Gerlach pointing up. And of course, the measurement creates 1 bit of entropy because just basically she will see the bit pointing up with probability 1/2 or pointing down with probability 1/2. Okay? And Alice's measurement has created 1 bit of entropy. Now, suppose that we have a Bob outside her isolated lab, and let's suppose that he has complete control of the degrees of freedom of her lab. And now to him, Alice's measurement is just a correlation of her lab's degrees of freedom and the spin's degrees of freedom, okay? So of course, it's a completely isolated lab. It will have a unitary evolution, and the measurement is just a correlation, an entanglement of the spin and Alice. Okay, so since it's a unitary evolution, entropy zero at the beginning, entropy zero at the end. And of course, he has complete control of the degrees of freedom of Alice's lab. And so he can flip a switch and implement some transformation. If you're familiar with quantum information, it's just a control knot transformation, which basically decorrelates again Alice and the spin. And the important thing is that, well, of course, first of all, this transformation will be incredibly complex because it must not leave any trace of the spin state in Alice's lab. But of course, in principle, this is possible. And the important thing to note is that in order to do that, he must erase completely the information about the measurement result, where the entropy, the bit of entropy was stored. Okay? Otherwise, there is no way he can factor the spin from Alice. So what happens? The final state is pure and factorized. And it has zero entropy, both from Alice's point of view and from Bob's point of view, because it's just a factor state of the two systems. But if you analyze it from Alice's point of view, a bit of entropy was definitely created by her measurement when she had measured a bit, but later it was erased by Bob. And the important thing is that in the end, Alice does not and cannot remember what the measurement result was. Perhaps she can remember that she had performed a measurement, like you were pointing out. But the bit of entropy was the measurement result. She cannot remember that. Okay? So this is the basic idea. Sorry?
She shouldn't even remember
that. No, she could do that.
But she can't because she can ask Bob, right?
Right.
Bob will confirm to her that she did perform a measurement, and she did at one point know, but then that's been erased.
Right. The important thing is the measurement result. That's where the bit of entropy was, right?
In a way, it seems, I mean, sorry, I really like this.
Okay.
I've given this example before, so I'm delighted to see
right.
Explanation. But there's a weird duality going on that there is a record that something happened.
Yeah.
But normally a something would be either up or down. You would have two options, right?
Sure.
And the content has been dragged out of that. So not
exactly.
That something happened. But the content of that has been erased.
Sure, sure.
It would be impossible.
It would be impossible.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, by the way, all my argument is almost trivial in some sense. So I hope you will bear with me. But somehow people thought it was interesting. What I talked about up to now was the von Neumann entropy, of course, but we can easily think of an analogous experiment involving thermodynamics entropy. And in order to do that, I will cite this very nice result that I will also need later, so please keep this in mind. And this is a recent nice paper by Popescu, Short, and Winter, which does sort of quantum statistical foundations of thermodynamics. And they basically point out that if you take almost any pure state of the universe that satisfy appropriate energy constraint, the state of almost all the subsystems which are sufficiently small are in a canonical, in a thermal state. Okay? I know this result is controversial, and I will talk about this controversy later, because you will see. But anyway, for what I'm going to use now, I'm just using it for the second thought experiment, and it shouldn't be. I'm using it in correct way. So now, the second thought experiment is the following. Bob is sending some light beam to Alice, which is in a pure state in a single mode. For example, it could be a Fock state, not a coherent state for reasons that are obvious. But Alice recovers it using various small detectors, which are uncorrelated between each other. So she is ignoring the correlations between the detectors. And now Alice is going to feel her detectors warming up. Her entropy has increased. She is losing the energy that Bob is sending to her. She's losing it as heat. But of course, Bob is outside the isolated lab. For him, this evolution is completely unitary. And again, he can invert, apply some other unitary, and recover all the energy she sent to Alice by decorrelating whatever got correlated in her lab, and he can recover the energy that he sent her. And of course, it looks like a violation of the second law from Alice's point of view, but again, at the end of Bob's last unitary, Alice will not and cannot remember of ever seeing thermal radiation at her detectors. Otherwise, Bob will not be able to recover the energy. Okay. And of course, this kind of points out that the just like von Neumann entropy, that thermodynamic entropy is a subjective quantity. It depends on the state of knowledge of the observer. So different observers will assign different entropies, even thermodynamic entropies, to the same systems. And of course, if I say that to an engineer, he will jump up and down. Because he will say, okay, I can always calculate the thermodynamic entropy of any transformation, like an engine. But in any practical situation, this statement is completely irrelevant because, of course, correlations in macroscopic objects are too complex to track and employ. So this is true. I mean, this has meaning only if we are interested in foundational aspects. Otherwise, it's really... kind of meaningless. So all these ideas somehow can be proved for arbitrary systems, and the statement is contained in this very simple relation, which where I have this delta S, which is the variation in entropy, and delta S a semicolon C, which is the variation in quantum mutual information, which is a quantity which basically measures the amount of both classical and quantum correlations between the two systems. Okay? So what does this equation mean? That any entropy decrease in a system is either because we've dumped the entropy into some reservoir or into the environment or somewhere else, or it is because we have decreased the quantum mutual information between the two systems, okay? And the proof of this equation is really very trivial because all we have to do is choose the reservoir R as a purification space such that the joint state of the system A, the system C, and the system R is a pure state, and that the evolution maintains the purity. Of course, we assume that this is always possible to do, and if we do that, then you just plug this relation in here, and you see that it's equal to zero. So it's really very trivial to prove this statement. Interpretation perhaps is not as trivial, but what we can say is that if Alice sees a decrease in entropy of a system C, then it means that her quantum mutual information with the system must have decreased, of course. And of course, unless we have been dumping the entropy into some other system. And unfortunately, in the paper, there was an error which was pointed out with a comment. And I was extending this statement also to the classical mutual information, not only to the quantum mutual information. But the classical mutual information, of course, is just an upper bound of the quantum case. And so that statement was incorrect. But this is quite uncontroversial. And of course, if we are looking, if we are dealing with a quantum framework I am working with, this is the quantity to consider, the quantum mutual information, because it measures the amount of quantum and classical correlations between two systems. Okay. And okay, so that was the result. And now let's analyze some consequences regarding these results. Okay. First of all, is quantum mechanics necessary? And of course, the answer is yes. And that is because only if you are in quantum mechanics, the entropy of a global system can be smaller than that of its subsystems. So the only bound we have is on the difference of the entropies. And this is not true classically, because the Shannon entropy, for example, is always bigger than the subsystem with maximal entropy. And of course, it's not true for classical thermodynamic entropy, where we are always ignoring correlations among subsystems. Okay, so quantum mechanics is necessary because of these simple properties of the von Neumann entropy. And so, of course, why don't we use quantum randomness is the obvious question. Isn't that sufficient? And the rationale behind this question is that if physical laws are intrinsically stochastic, then irreversible dynamics seem quite natural. I mean, if you're dropping an egg and you want to reverse this process, this messy process, you would have to very carefully and deterministically reverse all the microscopic degrees of freedom in order to get the undropped egg. And if the dynamics is intrinsically stochastic, then you won't do that. So why can't we use this in this framework? And of course, the answer is that quantum mechanics is not intrinsically stochastic, and it's fully deterministic. As I was saying at the beginning, the Schrödinger equation is reversible, and if you consider isolated system, a quantum randomness comes in only at the measurement. So the stochasticity of quantum mechanics by itself is not sufficient to explain the second law, how the entropy of an isolated system tends to increase. Okay. So another obvious objection is that entropy decreasing transformations can be seen. I mean, there are fluctuations. There can be statistical fluctuation in which entropy decreases. So wasn't this forbidden? Shouldn't this be impossible to remember? But you have to be careful and remember how we interpreted the formula. So we said that the reduction in quantum mutual information entails some destruction of the memory that is correlation with the observer only if one of the two systems is the observer. So the two systems, the memory erased is erased only if one of the two systems is the observer. Otherwise, if you consider systems that are uncorrelated from the observer, you can have a decrease in the correlation between them, and still you can witness a reduction of entropy. So then back to square one. Why don't we see macroscopic reductions of entropy, but only microscopic fluctuations? And of course, the answer of this question was known in some sense for many, many years, because macroscopic systems get correlated very quickly in most of their degrees of freedom. And that is, for example, on the basis of the decoherence problem. But even before the decoherence came out, there was this Borel calculation that pointed out this. So basically, if you have a macroscopic observer, Alice can never consider herself decorrelate from any macroscopic event. Okay, and just since I found this very, very nice, this calculation, I'm going to describe it very quickly. And Borel calculated that if you take 1 gram of matter, which is a macroscopic system, and you move it by 1 meter on the star Sirius, that can influence the trajectories of the particles in a box of gas on Earth on a time scale of seconds. Of course, you are neglecting the fact that there's going to be a few years for the signal to get to Earth. But I mean, this is quite amazing how, and this is considering gravitational interaction only. So it's basically tells you how sticky correlations are, how macroscopic systems in the whole universe get correlated very, very quickly.
Sure.
Yeah, but you can have also the opposite thing in which they get decorrelated, right?
I know. I'm just saying that if we're saying that systems get correlated very quickly, that doesn't explain their own time because they're already assumed for their own time.
No. When I'm talking about correlation, I can also talk about decorrelation. The important thing here is not to lose the symmetry of the argument, right? As long as everything I'm talking about, when I talk about correlation of different systems, I can also say the same thing about decorrelation, that's fine. I'm not assuming any error of time, right?
You're assuming that there is such a thing as time.
Yeah, of course.
But the arrow of time is just the backwards and forwards question.
Right, exactly. So as long as you can run a process forward, which correlates, but you can also run it backwards, which decorrelates, you have to explain why you only see the forward part and not the backward part. That's what I'm.
That all microscopic systems get correlated very quickly. You mean over time their tendencies to get very correlated?
Right, right. They interact, and so if they are uncorrelated, they get correlated. If they are correlated, they can get uncorrelated. That's all I'm saying. I'm not assuming one way here, right?
Oh, you mean that the extent of the correlation is very
right.
large?
Yeah.
The change in the correlation.
The change in the correlation is very large and very quick over large distances.
Okay,
that's all I'm saying. Yeah, maybe I didn't write it very clearly, but that's one.
Or
decorrelated, yeah,
oh,
right.
Okay.
Right. Sorry.
Say change in correlation.
Yeah. That's a good observation, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I completely agree. Thank you. Sure.
So, I think there's a problem with Borel's argument, but it isn't a big criticism, but it was compared. Each atom will be influenced by the motion of random matter
right.
on the star. But the relative position of two atoms is going to be insensitive to that because all three atoms feel exactly the same gravitational force up to incredibly small fractions from the star. So I think I disagree with the statement that most of the degrees of freedom of the macroscopic system get correlated. In fact, I think the vast majority of those degrees of freedom of the macroscopic system are relative positions of microscopic particles within. And those probably don't actually decohere. But I think your argument still goes through because that we don't see them. Because if they don't decohere, they are invisible. They don't interact with anything, right, including us. We can't see them.
Right.
So
yeah, but think about this. I'm not sure. I'm walking on a fine line here, so maybe I'm saying something wrong. But even if the difference between the gravitational field between these two things, these two situations, is very, very tiny on the box of gas. So the difference between what they feel if the gram of matter is in one place and if it's moved by 1 meter, the difference is very small. However, this is a highly chaotic system, so very tiny differences in the initial state will very quickly amplify.
That argument is so, classically true.
Yeah,
but
sure.
So quantum systems are not as sensitive to small perturbations, right? That's still unresolved.
Well,
the best results on that are the Luschmidt echo stuff, but
right.
it's not clear that chaotic
yeah.
results like that with exponential divergence will quantum systems.
What I would argue is that the microscopic degrees of freedom, even if you're considering a quantum system, will be very different in these two situations, but maybe
we should talk about this later.
Yeah, we should talk about this later. As you say, it's not that relevant. Maybe. Okay. So now I have one page summary of all that I am talking about. So basically this sums up all the argument I've given to you. And my argument, as I said before, is very, very trivial. And it basically says that only in quantum mechanics, correlation in a pure state is only due to entanglement, which in turn is responsible for the entropy of a subsystem of a system in a pure state. So basically, correlation and information and entropy are very tightly related through entanglement. Okay? And this is true only in quantum mechanics. And in other words, for people like Robin, which are familiar with the decoherence problem, all information about the decoherence event must be erased in order to have some recoherence. Okay, this is what I'm saying. This is a very simple statement of what all my argument is about. And of course, this is not true in classical mechanics because we can increase the correlations and the information as much as we want without touching entropy. For example, if we drop an egg, we can take photographs of this event, and in principle, we could invert, we could still retain the pictures and invert this event without any problem.
I'm a little
sure.
How important is the word all? I mean, couldn't I imagine a situation where, you know, decoherence event and somebody partly erases it?
Yes, but then you will only have a partly part.
Well, I know it'll presumably partially recohere.
Recohere, yeah.
But that's why I'm saying I'm not convinced the word all.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Unless anything you would erase.
Yeah, this is maybe the extreme of situation in which when you
all have everything in between from not erasing to fully erasing.
Yeah, maybe you can think of that also. That's true.
It's just that, but what bothers me is if I partly erase, then why can't the person make an intelligent guess about what would, you know, like a detective, this must be what happened if I only partly erased the picture, right?
But if he can still guess with certainty, then you have not erased.
So it must be, there's some intrinsic probability to the guess or something.
Right. Yeah.
That didn't work out.
No.
Or even some like precision, right? I mean, like, well, I guess if it's binary, that's...
Well, yeah, I mean, but there's got to be something in between all and nothing for doing this. Like, maybe a guy could decide to erase it.
Maybe
just because I'm thinking, like, if you're erasing a picture, you can imagine being able to film the picture, but only to some precision.
Right. If you look
it must be something like that. But presumably, this is quantifiable. So
I mean, probably the quantification comes from that very simple formula I gave before. In that case, you didn't have to have a complete removal of the entropy. You could have the partial case, and that is in some sense, a quantification of the in-between situation. This is the extremal situation, of course. Yeah.
Go ahead. Question that may help with that. I'm confused about you seem to have two notions of amount of correlations here.
Right.
One is the strength of the correlation, for instance, the amount of entanglement, right, or the mutual information between two things.
Right.
But then another seems to be the redundancy of the correlations. So, for instance, you talk about taking a snapshot.
Right.
Now, all the information about the splattered egg is currently encoded in the photon field around it. By every time you take a snapshot, you don't increase the mutual information, but you do increase the redundancy.
Yeah.
And so,
The mutual information there is already maximum, so you're just replicating it, right?
Right.
So in order to have this recoherence event, as you of course know, it's not sufficient to remove maybe, like if you took a million pictures and you decorrelate 990, I mean all but one, you still will not be able to have a recoherence. So you have to also decorrelate the last picture.
But I'm confused because in quantum mechanics, I can also increase the redundancy of correlations, the number of records, without touching the entropy, right?
Sure.
If I start with GDPR state and I turn it into GDC state.
Sure.
So what is it exactly that you're...
Oh, what I'm saying is that you can do that, but then in order to go back to reduce the entropy, you will have to remove all the copies, right?
So my question is, what exactly is the difference between classical mechanics and quantum mechanics? Because your statement about quantum mechanics, all information about a decoherence event must be erased, right?
Yeah. Erased means...
That has no meaning in classical mechanics because there are no decoherence events. But your statement about classical mechanics, right, which is true, you can increase correlations as well without touching entropy, is also true in quantum mechanics. So what exactly is the difference between classical and quantum?
I think he means the first picture.
Yeah.
Not meaning extra pictures.
Yeah. Yeah, the extra pictures just add redundancy, but once you have it.
So you're saying that in classical mechanics, you can make the first picture without changing the entropy?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's true. You can take a picture of some.
Even in classical theory, if I have two systems, A and B, A is the egg, B is going to be the picture of the egg.
Right.
In order for there to be correlation, so if there's a picture, there should be correlation, right?
Sure.
But I cannot have correlation unless A has some entropy. So in order to create correlation, I have to
yes,
create entropy.
But if the first system does have entropy, you know, it's 75% a broken egg and 25% egg that's intact. When you take the first picture, you haven't changed that entropy.
Right.
Okay,
but we can discuss some more about this. Maybe I should go on. Okay. So anyway, this is all I'm saying, and so if we want to discuss about this some more, I can come back. But now let me compare this with what are other solutions to the R of time. For example, Boltzmann's solution, he postulates that the initial state of the universe is a low entropy state. And then the increase in entropy is just due to the correlations that build up among subsystems. And so even if you have time-symmetric physical laws, you can have an asymmetric evolution just because we put the asymmetry into imposing a very specific initial state. And of course, the answer is how specific. And if you go and calculate that, this is an estimate given by Penrose. It's very, very specific. So somehow the initial state of the universe is very, very different from today's state. And in some sense, there is no time homogeneity. And of course, one can ask, where does the initial state come from? And of course, one can think of a fluctuation, but this is not the case, and of course.
Sure. The BC still doesn't solve the fact that due to the Liouville theorem, you still shouldn't have increase of entropy, right?
Because of the recurrence of things.
No, just because the volume in the base space doesn't change.
Oh, okay, but that's because you're assuming that you know completely, you have complete knowledge of the system, right? You have to have some coarse graining at some point. So maybe this argument is not by itself sufficient already.
I mean, you need coarse graining. So
right,
in some subject, you lost some information.
Yeah, okay, so you're saying that this statement is not correct. No, this statement is correct. You're saying that this does not entail that there is an increase in entropy by itself. Okay, yeah, sure. I could agree with that. Yeah. Okay. But what I'm saying here is that there can be some time asymmetry that comes in because you have put some asymmetry in the initial state. So you are postulating that the initial state is very different from today's, and that's where the asymmetry, the time arrow, comes from. Okay, this is the Boltzmann argument, basically. Okay, so why cannot it come from a fluctuation? And that is because of this very simple statement that if you have a very rare statistical fluctuation that maybe started from a high entropy state and went to a low entropy state, but it's much more probable that this random fluctuation lands the universe as it was like a second ago, together with our memories of having lived for more than a second, rather than the even more improbable state that it was like 13 billion years ago. So the fluctuation really doesn't help it. And it's even more probable that a single consciousness emerges from the chaos. So this is the so-called Boltzmann brain. So instead of having a universe that jumps out of the completely random state in an ordered state, you just have the minimum possibility is just some consciousness that thinks it's living in a universe, in an ordered universe. And this, of course, leads to solipsism, and it also contradicts observation, because as soon as I get out of this room, I would expect to see like a thermal equilibrium state, but that's not what I see.
I've never actually fully understood that argument, because right. How do you know that when you see what you see when you go out of the room, you fluctuated with that memory? I don't see how you could ever escape this solipsistic perspective. It doesn't really contradict observation. Whatever I observe next could have been a fluctuation that makes me think it's next, and I have the memory. What's wrong with that?
I don't know. I don't have an answer, but still, it's...
But it's more likely, I mean, the Boltzmann train argument, I think, is that it's more likely you would observe a small universe surrounded by chaos rather than a big universe, if you were a Boltzmann train.
Yeah.
Well, but whatever I observe, I can always, I can never be sure I'm not a Boltzmann brain, is my point. So
well,
in that sense, I don't see how it contradicts observation.
Well, it doesn't...
I mean, it's already 10 to the minus of Google that I'm going to be one in the first place. So I don't see why it matters if it's
well,
10 to
maybe,
the minus of Google times...
The point is that they're saying that it is vastly more likely that you're a Boltzmann brain, which means it's vastly more likely that you're... Impression of the universe has no predictive power. That statistically, you should be able to have, by this argument, you should statistically be able to have no predictive power except in just. You know,
but the reason why I don't understand that argument is because I'm a brain, if I am one of these things, I'm formed with memories that make me think I have predictive power. So when I walk out of the room, I still think I have predictive power.
Yeah, but the point is that it's much more likely that the moment you walk out of the room, the universe dissolves.
Right.
Than that.
But
know,
if it doesn't dissolve, how do I know that's not because I'm another brain fluctuating? And I don't think you can. I mean, you can say it's less likely, but I don't see why it's relevant to
well,
me.
Anyway,
you entertain this because
it's
brains
already...
are always created with memories that from the past, oh yeah, the whole thing was predictive or deterministic.
But no, that's the problem, is that the brains are not always created. I mean, if it's a fluctuation, if it's a random fluctuation,
yeah.
Then there'll be brains that are completed, that emerge with, you know, complete memories of a whole universe. There'll be other, but there'll be lots and lots and lots and many, many more other brains that evolve with, you know, having memories of having lived for 10 minutes, and before that,
I know that.
And so,
but
and the point is that such a brain is also capable of making this kind of argument and saying, why am I here? But we're not one of those brains. We're a brain with this huge, elaborate universe that seems much, much, much bigger than is necessary to explain just our individual existence.
Well, I guess I'm missing. I don't see how it's really.
So I guess we.
Well,
I don't see how you escape a bit of circularity of reason.
If I can.
That's my point.
If I can continue, it's. I think it's already bad enough that it leads to solipsism.
I'm not arguing with that.
Okay, so let's start with that.
I still think
yeah.
Even given what Daniel said, you can't really be sure you're not one of these nutball things because you're always created with the memories that
sure.
make the universe look ordered.
Sure, it's very difficult. I agree. It's very difficult to argue against solipsism because you can always find
not just because of this argument.
Yeah, not only
you
because
don't
of this argument.
I mean, this isn't supposed to be an argument against solipsism per se. It's against solipsism of this particular kind.
Right.
And solipsism with a probability distribution that's totally uniform over all brands.
You
over
know,
all
I think,
things, rather.
I think the point to me has always been that it's not that we actually think that there are any Boltzmann brains out there. The point is that a Boltzmann brain is an insane, absurd thing, and our universe, by this standard reasoning, is even less likely than a Boltzmann brain. That seems to me to be...
No, I realize that. That part I understand is the point. But I still think the point is you can't really be sure. This argument
okay.
doesn't persuade me that I can't
let's,
be sure I'm not...
Let's stop here, then. And,
but anyway, go ahead.
Okay.
But I agree with the other statement,
sure.
Yes.
Okay. So does quantum mechanics change the picture? So can I apply what I was talking about to the whole universe? Of course, you can always think that the unitary evolution applies to the whole universe. Of course, this is an even bolder assumption than I've used before. So because, of course, then gravity becomes important and we don't have quantum theory of gravity, but still. I mean, we can argue along these lines. And then we can say that the global state of the universe is pure and it maintains its purity. So it has zero global entropy. Like Alice, in her isolated lab, we may perceive an increase in entropy, even though, in fact, for an outside observer, if such thing existed, the entropy is always constant. So this seems to give a possible solution to Boltzmann's problem. Why does the initial state of the universe has so less entropy than today's? That's because it's always zero, at least for an outside observer, whatever that means. Okay? So, and one, well, okay, this is just to argue that a mixed state of the universe cannot exist, but maybe I will skip that. And so this is what I was talking about. And the initial entropy in this picture is not necessarily connected with the degree of entanglement of the initial state. You have to be careful about that. Otherwise, in some sense, you're just replicating the Boltzmann brain's arguments. So the initial state, the initial entropy is correlated with the lowest entanglement that has been reached in all the evolution, not the initial. Okay. Okay, so this is what I was saying. So, okay, now there has been an objection on this whole argument, and I'm going to talk about it, and I will give a possible way to overcome this objection. So any good arrow of time explanation must give an explanation of why, first of all, entropy only increases, and second, that the initial state was a low entropy one. So my proposal achieved both these goals because all observers only see entropy increasing transformation just because they are the only ones that leave information behind. The other ones do not. The entropy decreasing transformation do not leave information behind, like I argued. And moreover, this means that as any observer looks into his past, he will see entropy that is decreasing for decreasing time up to a small entropy initial state. So also the second requirement is fulfilled. So is my proposal a good arrow of time explanation? And the answer is maybe. As I was saying, there's an important objection, and I will give a possible reply to this objection. So it seems, in some sense, that it fails in one very important aspect. It doesn't seem to predict the entropy that any observer would see in what he feels is his own present, at whatever time that is. And this is because of the typicality argument I was talking before. Okay, typicality arguments seem to suggest, I'm not sure about that, that any observer should see a thermal equilibrium state at the present, right? But there are two buts to this. So this is the objection. And of course, we don't see a thermal equilibrium state, although our universe is almost at thermal equilibrium state because most of the degrees of freedom of our universe are stored in the photons of the thermal background radiation, which is a thermal equilibrium. So our universe is very close to thermal equilibrium, but it's still not quite at thermal equilibrium. However, in order to counter this objection, I will give two counter arguments. First of all, typicality arguments are based on the hard measure of states in the Hilbert space, and we have a very good evidence that physical states are not typical because they are branching states, as Robin knows very well. And branching states have very different characteristics from the physical state. This is a graph that I took from Robin's paper on quantum Darwinism. And it clearly shows that typical states have very different entropic characteristics than physical states, the states that we think are relevant for physics. So this seems to suggest that this typicality argument isn't really meaningful in our universe. And moreover, as Borel's calculation showed, our perception refers to a large part of the degrees of freedom of the universe just because we get entangled very quickly with most of the degrees of freedom of the universe. So we're not sufficiently small subsystems of the universe like their theorem seems to imply. Okay. So does my argument allow to remove all the time asymmetric hypothesis on what the initial state was and give a good R of time solution? Well, it depends really on how typicality relates to physicality. And this is a hotly debated topic. Okay, so to conclude, I have given a possible quantum explanation of why entropy increases, and that is because entropy decreasing transformation can happen, but they cannot leave any memory of their having happened. So they are completely irrelevant to physics. If we look into our past, we can never see them. And then I have given a possible quantum explanation on why the initial state of the universe has so less entropy than today's. The universe may well be in a zero entropy pure state, but it doesn't appear to us. Does that add up to a good R of time explanation? And the answer, as I said, is may. This is the take-home message, and thank you for your attention.
So there is something I do understand about your argument that entropy should always increase for some observer. So on the one hand, you say if it decreases, we don't know.
Right.
Exactly. On the other hand, at some point, you will have a recurrence, right? At some point, your global state of the universe will go back to some initial state. And so the local observer will at some point see an entropy that is smaller than...
The observer, when you have the recurrence, the observer will not, of course, have any memory, because all the degrees of freedom where her memory are also have experienced recurrence. So, I mean, maybe we are like the 100th recurrence of this event, but we will never be able to know that, right? So it's irrelevant.
I mean, in this picture, entropy could be decreasing all the time, but none of us ever remember.
Exactly, yeah, that's the point.
Okay, and
Well, then we remember the direction where it was increasing.
Well, okay,
where's your math, but I think you were saying there could be entropy increases and entropy decreases simultaneously going on, but we only remember the entropy.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So this can be, we have both all the time, but the only thing we remember is the one way.
Yeah, that's the idea.
But this thing doesn't, why are there observers of the universe at all?
Oh, okay.
By which I mean, why are there subsystems that are able to make such perceptions? Rocks can't do it. Gas can't do it.
Well, we can certainly.
Yeah, but what is this property that allows this?
Yeah, the way up here, you just translate the arrow of time to the anthropic principle. Right?
Yeah, that's what it seems to be, too. That's not necessarily bad, but at some point it begs the question as to why there are observers that can understand what a trace of information is.
Well, no, I think this
stuff
is...
can't. A rock would have no idea if entropy is going up or down.
Right.
Well, a rock wouldn't be able to think of it abstractly, but a rock can record information. Right, if some cosmic ray hits a rock, the rock records that.
Records is meaningless unless there's a mind to interpret.
Well, so
how do you know if a tree falls in the forest?
Well,
no one's there.
So I mean,
the record is relevant to us,
but it's not relevant to the rock.
Sense.
I mean, it begs the question of the meaning of an observer. I mean, these animals in the slides, right? They're not the observers, for example.
Sure, I think this is beyond. What?
I know it's beyond the scope, but in some sense, I think it does rephrase the question somewhat along the lines.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe what this does solve is it says, so rather than making the improbable thing be that the universe started in such an ordered state, now the improbable thing is that we should see it in such a, that we should have seen the universe evolve in such a path from a gas. And so now, even though it's like the improbability has been moved from the beginning of the universe to where we are now. And at least where we are now, we can invoke anthropic principle, whereas before we couldn't. In a sense. I don't know.
Maybe.
Sense.
The other thing this reminds me of, there's this paper, I think it's by somebody named Schumacher, who did seem to indicate that in distant regions of the universe, you could, without contradiction, have arrows of time going in different directions. So people over here, if they could communicate, could warn people over there that it's about to rain and they should shut the window and vice versa. But this would suggest that actually what he says is not permitted, it seems to me. Have you ever looked at this?
No, I didn't.
It's about 5 or 6 years old.
Okay,
Schumacher.
Okay, I'll take a look. It does seem quite weird, so I have no
idea. I think that's the idea. It's with an S. Schulman, maybe. Schulman, Schumacher. I can't remember. Schulman, maybe. I can't remember the name of the author. I'll have to look it up.
Pardon.
I know it begins with S.
It's more likely to be Ben Schumacher than Schulman, but it could be neither of them.
It's Schulman or Schumann. I forget which one it is. Maybe it's Schulman. Leonard Schulman.
Schulman's written a lot about time symmetric formal.
It might be, yeah.
It's probably.
I'll see if I can look it up.
Great, thank you. Yeah.
So I have a question, just based on this interpretation. So we consider the universe from the perfect observer who could see the universe at time equals whenever it was like a hot gas of this big. To time equals now. Does this imply that the universe looks at the wave function of the universe where time equals now the majority of the, does that imply that most of the components of that wave function are very correlated? I mean, does that imply that if he looked at this, most of the time he would continue to see a hot gas? Because, I mean, the implication here would seem to be that hot gas doesn't generally expand, right? I mean, so like the universe didn't generally like thermodynamically expand and cool off, but that rather.
I'm not sure I understood the question, but the nice thing of this picture is that you can still have these fluctuations, like in the Boltzmann thing. But if Alice is here, she can also remember her past as here. She will not be able to remember a past in which the entropy was higher.
Well, my point is just
that she can remember when the entropy was lower.
My point is that
the entropy
of the universe does not increase, if that's your solution, that implies that when the universe started in a state that's a ball of hot gas,
right.
it generally didn't evolve into a bigger hot gas, because that would require thermodynamic evolution. So in general, the universe doesn't expand from a quantum perspective.
Yeah, maybe you can. I mean, this is completely. It doesn't. The initial state of the universe doesn't enter into this picture. So it can be anything, including a high entropy system, thermodynamic high entropy system like you're pointing out. It really doesn't enter into this picture at all. The initial state could be very high entropy, meaning, of course, that it's highly entangled over all the degrees of freedom, because, of course, we know that global state of the universe would be pure, but as long as there are fluctuations, an observer now could remember these fluctuations, so he would see entropy going down as he looks into his past. So yeah, the initial state could be anything.
But my real question is just in some objective view. So if you had the whole universe, the whole wave function of the universe, would you conclude that if the universe started in this low energy teeny ball of hot gas, it didn't actually evolve most of the time into something bigger than that? Even though to us at this time, we think it evolved, because we saw it evolved. But to an objective universe viewer, you wouldn't have seen it evolve, because that's...
I don't think you can reach any of these conclusions here. I mean, I don't think you can really say whether an objective observer would see one or another type of evolution from these arguments alone.
And that objective observer can't exist in a strong sense, right? I mean, in one sense that no observer can see the wave function, right? But even more than that, every bit of data that we have about the universe is based on perceptions of very small parts of it. And so we have no basis whatsoever for concluding anything about what the universe would look like to an observer that could see more than a tiny fraction of the universe, right? And it's entirely possible that it would look like a giant marshmallow, or that it would look like my mom. I mean, it would almost certainly not look like something containing stars and galaxies and all that crap, right? It's beyond human comprehension by definition. So to some degree, speculating about what the universe, all of it, looks like is a lot less intellectually reputable than speculating about the nature of God.
Adding to this comment, there is a very nice paper by David Albert in which he argues that the universe may well be in vacuum state. And it's fully consistent with what we see.
Yeah,
So it's a paper that he wrote a few years back.
So, I mean, I'm trying to understand exactly what your picture is here. So the idea is that you said if we're in the small dip on the right in this picture,
right,
then we can remember what happened in the bigger dip further to the left. And so the idea then is that we have kind of our memory of the universe is a collection of going back as progressively bigger dips.
Yeah, that could be a possibility, sure. That's one way to completely take away any hypothesis on the initial state of the universe, just because the initial state could be anything.
So what we remember as the initial state was actually just some freakishly large fluctuation.
Right, yeah.
And since then...
That is consistent. I'm not saying that is the case, but that is consistent with this picture.
But, sure.
Why then would we see the entropy consistently increasing? Why couldn't we remember, you know, a big fluctuation a little while ago and then a smaller fluctuation, but still bigger than ours before that, and then, you know, some...
Just because you remember that you cannot see anything that goes down. You can only see up. So Alice here will not be able to realize there have been any fluctuations. She will only see...
No, I understand that. But yeah. I suppose there were two bigger fluctuations than ours in the past.
Sure.
Right? So then there's a couple of up things.
Yeah, this is the case, yeah.
But so first of all, I mean, it already seems like a problem because you see two big up things that are not consistent with each other.
Why they're not consistent? Once you get here?
No. The problem is your picture only has two dips. What if you had a third dip?
A third dip here?
Yeah.
But you remember that it's still this stair-steppy thing that's monotonically not increasing.
Yes, but you remember it. But you remember it increasing. Well, why do you remember it increasing in a consistent way as opposed to an inconsistent way?
Consistent.
Right. I don't understand.
Well, look. So you're drawing it. So we're in the third dip here.
Yeah. So we could see this, and then this, and then this.
Yes, but why don't we see?
So this could be
what is the horizontal line mean? So we don't remember that part at all, right?
Yeah, it means anything. Right?
So, but why not see a bigger upswing in the first one, and
Sure. You can also have something like that.
But why does it have to be continuous like that? I mean, that
no, no, it doesn't. I don't understand your question.
The argument that you're making is that we can only remember the up slopes, right? But why do the up slopes have to piece together to make a consistent history if they're coming from different fluctuations?
Can you draw something that wouldn't look like that?
Right.
So why couldn't you just have two marginal?
Well, that doesn't look like that. I think that's his point, that we remember a universe.
I mean, from what,
all of a sudden, boom, the whole universe changes and looks ordered.
From what
right?
you said,
but
why,
it's not
why couldn't
one
remember,
we remember?
Why couldn't remember, for instance, this part, okay, and then this part, and then this part.
Ah, okay, I see.
Right, that's not consistent with what we see.
Why wouldn't it be consistent?
We've got time going backwards.
That's
the point, you don't get why.
You only remember the time, look, so the time that's coordinated in this picture has very little to do with the time that
exactly.
you remember.
Exactly.
That's
yes.
what he said.
Exactly.
Okay, that's his point. And the point is, the time that you remember is the process of going up one of those slopes.
Right.
But why do they have to be slopes that piece together in this picture?
Yeah, I don't understand why. I mean, maybe I hadn't thought about this, but maybe you can have this, but I don't see why it would be inconsistent with our memories.
Well,
why
I mean,
it would be
much more dreamlike in the sense that you have something happening
right.
and then something else that's unconnected to it happens.
Why
and
would
then
this
you go
be?
Back to the first
why
thing.
Would this be
but
something
it's,
else?
I
this
would say it's bad enough to even jump over once because, you know, on that first upward slope, you remember a consistent universe, and all of a sudden, poof,
well,
that universe changes.
That's
bad enough because it does not correlate with human
right.
experience. So once you've got that bad, whether you go forward or back doesn't matter a whole lot. Because you know, it's like Alice in Wonderland, and poof, again, oh, now I'm back in this other universe that I remembered before, but what difference does it make? You've already screwed it up badly enough the first time.
But you've gone back in time.
But so what? How would you know what time is anyway? I mean, the whole universe has been reconfigured.
Yeah.
So why, I mean, it seems to me the first jump is a big enough problem. Once you've got that, all hell breaks loose, as they say.
Yeah,
well,
it's not like going back in time in the, like, the film.
No, the whole universe has been erased. So your conditions are exactly the same.
Yeah.
For example, how do I know I've gone to the right in the first place? I could have just as well jumped over to the left on something that looked one is bad enough.
What I don't understand is why are you saying that this is distinguishable from this?
Because they're different fluctuations of the universe.
Okay?
There's many, many ways that the universe can be relatively low entropy.
Yeah.
Right? And each of those little vertical upswings is an evolution in one particular fluctuation. So it'll have, you know, a bunch of things happening that are all kind of consistent. But upswings in totally different dips, there's no reason that they should be at all similar, right? One of them is a universe where we live on a planet called Earth and blah, blah, blah. Another one, you know, we live on Vulcan and we have 20 years, right? And why if actually our memory is pieced together from a bunch of different swings, why aren't we taking pieces from some of them and pieces from other of them?
That's Hinduism. It's past lives.
So I guess my picture was that you're just going to start in one of these Vs, and you remember from the bottom of the V to wherever you are, and you're only at one of the peaks, and you only remember to
the
bottom of the
V. Okay, but then you really are in the Boltzmann brain case.
But it doesn't seem anything, nothing's stopping you from all of a sudden finding yourself at the bottom of another V, and the problem is what Daniel said, that the bottom of each V is in principle completely different from from all the other bottoms. So you find yourself remembering you're in an ordered state, it's progressing a bit of entropy, you see development, but all of a sudden you're in a different low entropy state with a memory of the previous one. So it's like the universe transforms like that. We don't see that happening. Everybody remembers themselves coming up from the same bottom. Why?
Unless it's self-existing. Actually, I'm not. The way I saw it is that the only way you can have a jump like that is if these entropies match very, very closely, which means that basically it's the same.
But they do match.
Right? You can have two states.
Sure, of course.
You know, they're very different, but they have the same entropy.
Yeah,
I think what's being suggested is that generically, if a lot of time evolves for Bob, right, one of those plateaus, no time is evolving for Alice because Alice can't remember that plateau, right? So it's like an instant for her, and yet the state is very different at the bottom of the rightmost V, and we're at the point labeled A.
Yeah.
Right.
That could be.
Yeah. The same entropy and states are very.
Same entropy that states.
Now, I mean, I guess I can believe that the particular picture I drew where you go back might be disallowed because you're erasing things and then. Once they're gone, you can't get them back. But it is true, I think, that when you go to different dips, I mean, you could, basically the idea is you have some correlations that are stuck, you erase a bunch of them, and you make some new ones instead, but why should they have any, if you haven't erased them all, why should they have any connection to the previous things?
Why are we saying that they have connections to the previous things?
Because the point is that our memory of history is a continuous narrative that makes sense together, not something that has crazy jumps at various points into totally different universes.
Well, I don't really understand why we're suggesting that these crazy jumps exist in the
first
place.
Well, this is because you forgot.
Well, this is my interpretation.
You go down, you forget.
His argument that you have these, a bunch of, that you've pieced together history from a bunch of different jumps.
I guess what I would argue with is, yeah, exactly, that isn't quite I don't really see that either.
I guess that's what I'm saying. I don't really see that.
This is what this slide is saying. This is why it's not a Boltzmann ring.
I don't think that's what the slide's saying, because I don't think the slide says that you're going to jump from. Well, my interpretation of this is that you're not going to jump from one of those beats to another one of those beats.
No, but you don't remember. What you remember, so every time you go down in entropy, you forget. So for you, for your perception, what happened, you are jumping. And these are two different configurations.
Okay, well, so I guess
discontinued.
I guess maybe what it is that it is unlikely. This could be happening, but I mean, this seems like kind of an artificial construction. I think that like this is something that was created because Bob engineered it to happen, but this isn't the way that the universe typically. We're not suggesting that this is typically what happens in our universe. Our universe
I think,
is one of those species.
Yeah, I think that if you want to avoid any.
Then there is an explanation.
Right, if you want
that doesn't solve the Boltzmann ring problem, but it does at least resolve this particular thing. And I guess the answer is that these fluctuations are generally so small that you don't notice them. They're the things that you need.
The whole point of the argument, or part of the point of the argument, was that those fluctuations could be big, right? Because we started with the idea that maybe one of those fluctuations created the universe's low entropy initial state. But I think that there's something interestingly wrong, not wrong, but that this figure misses. Just that, imagine we've got the Alice and Bob thing going on, right? And Alice is a complex observer, so there's many aspects of her environment, not just one spin, that she could observe. And at any given time, she could forget any one or maybe any two of those. You can imagine a sort of an equilibrium state where she's constantly learning and then forgetting. And there's occasional fluctuations where she forgets five or six of them at once. And so then when she forgets five spins, her entropy drops by 5 bits. But the catch is that what that figure doesn't capture is that it's not just the total amount of entropy, the total amount of information that she has that matters. If she forgets about spins A, B, and C, that's different from forgetting about spins F, G, and H.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
This is a one-dimensional plot, and it just looks at information, but information is contextual. It's about different things. And that may actually, I can't do this in my head, but that may resolve what you're talking about. If you almost like a recursive computation, where the only things that you forget are uncomputation of specific things.
It's conceivable, but I don't think so. I mean, I'm open to a more elaborate argument that would try to establish that. The reason I don't think so is that in order to get out of this Boltzmann brain argument, you need the high parts in the diagram, the parts where you get back to basically full.
But what he was pointing out actually does have that, because you can
I mean, yeah, you don't get nice clean things like that. You get more complicated.
No, but also, I mean, what he's pointing out is that maybe this fluctuation. This intermediate fluctuation just is erasing some other degrees of freedom. So when you get back here, you are exactly in the same state you were here, right? Just because this part is acting on different degrees of freedom than this part, in some sense, right?
That's not the same state, right? That's a totally different state. I guess what Robin is saying is that your piece. I mean, this doesn't answer the question, but I think. What he's saying is that the different dips represent not just different parts of your memory, but different parts of the universe.
Sure.
And so you piece together. But nevertheless, for any given part of the universe, you need a series of different dips in order to go all the way back in time.
But if this, let's imagine we have a multi-dimensional version of this curve. There could be just two, right? On the vertical axis, you're plotting entropy with respect to subsystem A of your universe. And then perpendicular to it, there's entropy with respect to subsystem B. And this means how much you know about A and about B, right? Then in that case, if we take a different axis for every chunk of your universe, then indeed, there is, when your information about A drops, there's only one way for it to drop, which is you forget about A. which is say that, that now entropy and states are in one-to-one correspondence. The new problem is that you've got your memory now consists of many separate memories. Your memory about A, your memory about B, and your memory about C, and you have to ask why those are the same.
I don't think this picture is going to work very well. The problem is, of course, you have this graph is about the subsystem. These beeps are not beeps of the whole universe. In the whole
of course,
universe, it's zero.
It's zero.
Yeah. So that means. So but this is the subsystem of the observer.
Yeah, exactly.
So Robin is suggesting that you divide the rest of the universe into subsystems as well. But it's not enough then to make your own correlation with the other subsystems.
Actually,
they can be correlated with each other.
Yeah, it's your
and you have memories of that and
I mean, I see where you're coming from now. The assertion is that why the reason why you don't have a bulge-thin brain is because you actually see past the bulge-thin brain fluctuations to the beginning of the universe, is what this picture is saying.
Yeah.
So that asserts that there have been bulge-thin brain fluctuations, but you've been skipping over them because, for reasons. Because
the same
higher
entropy.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So you're,
I think what Robin is saying is that when here you remember some sort of events, and here these relate to some other degrees of freedom that then can be erased completely, and then you're back to where you were at the first place, right? Because simply these parts refer to different degrees of freedom. That's what you're saying. At least that's what I understood your counter argument, which I like.
So since I'm here, and we hopefully don't have to debate too much what I'm trying to say, unless I just suck explaining. What I'm suggesting is that we should take this graph to represent not the total entropy of the observer Alice, but her entropy sort of with respect to a particular subsystem in the environment, and then in order to go. So when you fluctuate, this means you forgot something here. And then you learn things, right? You're learning things about this specific thing in your environment. Okay, fine. Oh, and then you forget a bunch of things. But the point is that if we take this vertical axis to refer to information about a specific property, then the only way to forget about that property is, in fact, to go back to exactly the same state that you were here. You can't go to a different state that has the same entropy. If this entropy is only talking about a single property, then we have to draw billions and billions and billions of these graphs simultaneously for lots of different properties.
So I guess the way I'm viewing the situation is that the assertion is that the reason why it looks so, it almost seems like we are not in this fluctuation. This fluctuation is highly improbable. The explanation is that that's okay. We're in this much more probable fluctuation. But for some reason, we can actually see, when we look, we actually see all the way down here, because we can see everything that's lower than this. But what seems strange to me is that this implies that, if we're on one of these more improbable fluctuations, that there were Boltzmann brain fluctuations by this argument between the start of the universe and where we are. So why don't we see the Boltzmann brain fluctuation, since that's actually, it's more likely that lots of these fluctuations happen between the universe creating fluctuation and are much more probable fluctuating. And so by this argument, why isn't it that we see the
brain? I think one point it's kind of missing in all this debate is that these, if you are considering the quantum universe picture I've been considering up to now, these are not fluctuations, right? It's coherent evolution of the whole universe. It's different.
Do you mean this picture? I mean,
this picture.
This picture was of the whole universe. People are saying, no, it's just Alice's entropy. And now, what is it? Is it
because this is zero for the universe? It's
So that's right. So the entropy is zero.
This is Alice's
for the whole
universe. This is Alice's point of view, and the evolution of the whole universe is unitary. So these that appear to Alice as fluctuations.
But then I'm still puzzled partly by this and partly why can't Alice remember something for a while and then jump to a brand new state in this picture that looks completely different but has the same entropy. I don't see what's stopping.
You're saying that somebody has intermittent memory and then still able to meet all of their memories in a continuous space.
I'm willing to accept a picture more like this. I guess I'm more okay with this picture if we don't use it as an explanation of why a Boltzmann brain, we don't see Boltzmann brains. It's like for, I'm okay with this picture if we're not using it for an explanation for why.
This is just telling us something about the initial state. I mean, you need this picture just in order to argue that you don't have to impose some particular initial state, that any initial state will still work. This is the point of this.
Any initial state will cause you to see
entropy increasing and some low entropy initial state. Yeah.
So just to make sure I'm not taking this wildly the wrong way, I'm what I take this picture to mean is that from Bob's perspective, in as much as Bob has a perspective kind of outside of Alice's universe, the universe has been evolving for, you know, unitarily, which is say Alice's universe, has been evolving for 10 to the 160th years, some unbelievably long period of time, and it's been fluctuating up and down. But Alice's memory is much, much shorter, because essentially all that Alice remembers is, you know, these sort of, her instance of time are the jump from one fluctuation to the next. And the oldest thing that she remembers is the lowest fluctuation that has happened ever in history. And the second oldest thing is the next lowest fluctuation, which from Bob's perspective might have been 10 to the 80th years later.
So by my argument, though, that doesn't explain why she doesn't remember all these Boltzmann brain fluctuations.
I agree.
I agree. That doesn't explain that.
So no. I mean, the reason is because that the, I mean, we're currently in a fluctuation that's much, much lower than a standard.
I'm okay with that, but I'm okay with that explanation. But what I'm almost seeing here is if that's all that's going on, then I'm okay with that. It's an attempt to say the reason why we see the beginning of the universe is because that's a lower fluctuation in the brain. Like I'm okay with the argument as you put it, but if we're extending it to this other picture, then I'm starting to disagree with it.
But I mean, the question is, what would a Boltzmann brain look like, right? From Bob's perspective, this is a Boltzmann brain coming into existence and then decaying, right, rotting. But what does Alice remember? Alice remembers from here to here as a single indivisible instant of time, right? I mean, those are adjacent in her memory. Because
she remembers the upswing.
Only
upswing in the first.
Okay, so she remembers, right, her memory goes like,
yeah,
this.
Then we said chunk.
So, fine, the Boltzmann brain happened. And there is an element of Alice's memory that corresponds to the Boltzmann brain. But a Boltzmann brain is a downward fluctuation in entropy, right? And the only part of that, of that whole fluctuation that Alice remembers is that, essentially. So, I guess what I'm saying is that, yes, the Boltzmann brain is part of Alice's memory, but not as a Boltzmann brain. She only remembers the decay half of the Boltzmann brain, so it doesn't look like a Boltzmann brain to her.
But look, the decay half, okay, so even adopting your version of this, where, I guess it's okay.
But still, that brain state could be very different than the state that it came from on the left.
Yeah, that's
they have the same entropy, but they could be very, very different things.
But that's what I was trying to argue against before.
Well, I know, but I don't see how it. I don't see anything.
Well, I actually buy his argument. I think it's.
I don't buy his argument. So the problem.
Maybe we do.
The problem is that you can try to draw these. But getting back to the way I drew this segment, so even assuming Robin's version of this, that the stuff that gets erased has to be the stuff that was made here.
Exactly.
Okay? It doesn't have to be this part. It can be some part in the middle.
Yeah.
That's definitely
yeah.
true. Right? This is generating, this segment here is generating
yeah.
lots and lots of correlation. That's between Alice and the rest of the universe.
So, right.
Okay? And what we're erasing here can be any of those.
But those correlations are fungible. In other words, there's a one-to-one correspondence between the vertical
but
axis
but
and
they're not, right? I mean,
yeah,
but that's the core
yeah,
of the
yeah,
argument that
yeah.
that I think you.
Yeah.
The
why
that
should
I made
that be true? I don't. Why should, I mean, that's an additional thing imposed here, and it's not clear that when you put in lots and lots of these things that you've actually, seems to me you've destroyed the simplicity
yeah,
of
but,
the explanation.
Yeah, but no, no, because you still have to consider that it's a unitary evolution, right?
Yeah.
So every time you have decorrelation here, it's on some degree of freedom, which is the same here, right? Because.
But that's actually not the case, because there have been lots of small dips that have erased various things in between.
Yeah.
So this is the part of Rob's argument that I don't buy.
Well.
And replace them with other kinds of correlations. I mean, yeah, so I don't see it.
Maybe I'm wrong, but at least let me try to make the argument. If just looking at this curve, you would think that the instance that you would remember would be
you remember the slopes.
Fine, along with the corresponding successive slopes.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is you have to draw one of these curves for every degree of freedom that you can observe and remember. So here's another one in parallel, right? And Bob's time, the absolute time in this picture, is evolving the same rate.
Mm-hmm.
And so actually, where this picture, this is about, system A. You don't remember anything in here. This happens as an instant to you.
Yeah.
But you do actually have a memory from this point, because property B is fluctuating independently, or it was a independent part.
Mm-hmm.
And so your timeline then includes an event here as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm going to do is, instead of talking about the entropy of the entire, and another event here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now what I can't figure out on the spot is whether it's even possible to reconcile the timelines. Why our timelines for different systems would not slip, would be reconciled, right? But the
generally,
if each of these refers to a single property of the environment.
Is it supposed to be a binary property?
That's a good question. I'm only on safe ground if I say yes. So yes, let it be a binary property.
Actually, here, I've got another picture. So we can also play games in the other dimension, which is space, which is it's much more likely that a fluctuation would cause our solar system to appear without the rest of the universe.
Right.
So what?
Well, that's again the Boltzmann brain.
That's the same Boltzmann brain problem.
I know. So my point is that so if we're saying that, so in those cases we wouldn't be able to see to an even lower frequency. You see what I'm saying? So this doesn't solve. The point is that this doesn't solve the Boltzmann brain problem because
no, I don't think it does. That's why I'm not persuaded by the argument. I don't think it solves it at all.
Oh yeah, my argument is why this picture doesn't solve. But I guess
yeah,
I'm
fine.
And that's why the later dip will be very different than the earlier dip, because you've done a lot of erasing already.
By the way, thank you for letting us argue about this. I think about more in quantum computing stuff all day, so this is more fun stuff. This is new stuff to argue about.
Yeah, but actually I do too. I also had a slide at some point, which I put in some talks. And you still have it. Yeah. This is not part of my punch research. Because it's kind of weird. But it's certainly fun.
So I guess it's time to thank the speaker, indeed.